my name is Louise, and I'm the community support worker for Mid and West Devon, and we're really pleased to welcome Graham Flynn to the call today, who is the CEO of Devon Insight. So Graham's going to be talking to us about his background, and I will be asking him some questions so that we can all get to know him that little bit better. Hopefully, if there's some time at the end of the talk, we will open it up for you to ask anything you may wish to know. Okay, so good morning, Graham.
Hello, Louise. How are you?
I am very well, thank you. And yourself?
I'm okay. I don't like being on the spot like this.
Wow. You've got a lot of good questions to come, so be prepared.
I will. Firstly, can I just say a personal thank you to everybody who submitted a question? I think a few of them have been planted. I had sighted them and I've had a chance just to look through them, and I think a few might come from the staff, so there's a few little surprises there, which is funny.
We couldn't possibly comment on that, Graham.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's begin. Are you ready?
Yes.
So can you tell me a little bit about where you grew up and your school time?
Okay, I was born in Sutton in Surrey in 1967, so that makes me 53. My dad worked in the concrete industry. So for those who are interested, the Amy Roadstone Corporation, ARC, is where my dad worked. And my mum was a housewife until I was about 16, 17, and had three sons under the age of five. We moved around a bit. We lived in St Ives in Cambridgeshire, Alverley near Bridgnorth, but I ended up in Frome in Somerset in the late 1970s. Schooling. I went to Selwood Middle School before I went to Frome College. And it's where, when I was at Frome College, I started volunteering for the local theatre, which is called the Merlin Theatre. I did lots of behind-the-scenes work. I trained as a lighting and sound technician. I designed stage sets, did the occasional acting job, and I also projected movies. One link with sight loss is I actually helped to record the local talking newspaper, so I was doing that in the early 1980s. Just a couple of plays that I worked on, just because there's been sort of developments recently with both of these. One of the first plays I ever did was a play called The Chicken Run, which was written by a guy called Aidan Chambers. And Aidan has written screenplays for lots of big Hollywood movies. And I played, rather ironically, a character called The Mute. It was a motorcycle gang. And I was a mute, and all the clothes we were wearing were adult motorcycle leathers, and we were all sort of in our early teens, so we looked a bit ridiculous in these oversized stuff. But one of the great things about that particular play was learning the power you can have as an actor with the audience. And there's a bit of it where I had an arm wrestle with the lead character. And I lose. And then there's a bit where I look out at the audience. So I've had my hand burnt. I've looked out at the audience. And the director had always said, when you're looking out at the audience, don't move your head when you look to the next actor. Just move your eyes. And I remember the first time I did that, I just moved my eyes and looked at the character stood to the right of me. And I watched the whole audience turn their heads. So it was the power of very subtle movements on stage, yes, and also the power of silence. So, yes, you know, the use of pausing in acting and presentations, and that's something I try and do today. The other big play I did was a play called Safe House, which was written by the guy who devised Emmerdale Farm. I think it's just called Emmerdale now. Yep. That was the first time I suffered from a really bad bout of stage fright. I nearly flew out the stage. I literally lost my words for a few milliseconds. It was only milliseconds. But for me, it lasted for what seemed like hours. And, you know, you can hear the tumbleweed and all that sort of stuff. And it was horrendous. So that was a couple of plays I did. I've put down here in my notes the first person who paid me any money in the theatre. I worked with Harry Corbett and Sooty, and I did 2 days of his tour, and I had the whole theatre to myself, Harry Corbett and Sutee. And I took a few photos of Harry, and he was lovely. And at the end of the show, he shook my hand, and I could feel that there was a piece of paper in my hand, and he paid me £20. Now, £20 in the early 80s was a lot of money, and he was the first person to ever pay me. So as you can guess, my real passion was for art and theatre. And having done the sort of the junior stuff and senior school at Froome College, I went to sixth form at Sexies School in Bruton. Seriously, my school was called Sexies. And the address of the school was Sexies School, Lusty Lane, Bruton. Absolutely hilarious. And it was founded by a guy called Hugh Sexy. Anyway, that environment there, going to a sort of sixth form school, was great. And I met a really inspirational art teacher called Alan Clark, who's sadly no longer with us. And there are two things I just wanted to say here, which was that I really regret now that I never had the opportunity to say to Alan how brilliant and inspirational he had been. But remember, I was just talking about the Chicken Run and Aidan Chambers. Last year, I wrote to Aidan Chambers through his agent, and a little package arrived through the post, and he sent me a first edition of his play, and he'd dedicated it to me, and it was to the mute, which was the character I played. So that's really nice, and it's kind of nice in life sometimes to go back and thank people for the inspiration they had on you as a young person. So there you are. So there you are. That's growing up in school.
Fabulous. Which leads on to, which university did you go to, Graham?
I didn't.
Sore
point. I was creativity runs through my family. On my mother's side is a Victorian family of artists called the Earps, E-A-R-P. And one of my relatives was the great niece of Sheriff Wyatt Earp. They were all prolific watercolor artists. One of them became a costume designer in Hollywood. T.W. Earp, who was an art critic, he was very famous for a case to do with the Elgin marbles. And I don't know if people know, listeners know this, but the Elgin marbles were cleaned when they were brought over from Greece. They were cleaned with acid to make them go white. And T.W. Earp got very, very annoyed about this. And D.H. Lawrence coined the phrase twerp, T.W. Earp. That's what he called him for this complaint. So there you are. So the twerp expression comes from my family. And I'm a twerp too sometimes. I was put forward for a degree course in graphic illustration at Brighton Polytechnic. Remember, we had polytechnics. I think they're all universities now. Yeah. And a funny thing happened there. I went for my interview panel and I got my portfolio out. And the interview board focused on one particular painting I'd done. And it was an A-level piece. And the cover was for a book called Carnivorous Plants. And they looked at this piece of work and they laughed. I'd made up the name of an author. I'd called it Basil Amaryllis was the author. And one of the men on the panel asked me what the inspiration was for the border on this particular painting. And what I'd done is I'd done all these smudges, because it was all about sort of carnivorous plants. I'd done smudges like fingerprints around the outside of the border. And this guy said, what was your inspiration for this? So I said, very honestly, that my inspiration was Fungus the Bogeyman by Raymond Briggs. And there was lots of smirking on the panel, and we moved on to other questions. At the end of the interview, the chairman of the panel apologized for smirking during the interview, and he stood up and he held out his hand and he said, oh, by the way, my name is Raymond Briggs. So the man himself had interviewed me, but I didn't get a place at the art school. But the lesson there was always tell the truth, particularly in interviews. Don't wing it, because the man himself was sitting in front of me. So there you are. That was that. So I failed to get a place on an interview course, on a degree course, and my parents insisted that I got a proper job. So I was shoehorned into the police. My dad wanted to be a policeman in the 60s. He was the right height, but in those days, in the Metropolitan Police, they didn't have people with certain eyesight problems. So my dad couldn't get in. So I think I became a policeman to keep my dad happy. And I also liked Sherlock Holmes books, so I sort of thought that maybe that would be all right.
That's a good enough.
So the answer to your question is no, I didn't go into university. And my experience has been very much sort of the University of Life. I've attended the University of Life, and that education continues today. I've met some lovely people who've been to university, but I've also met some extraordinarily pompous people. And when I was writing my notes, I'm reminded of something that happened to me once in London. I was a guest at the St. Nicholas Feast at a livery company in London. And it was the company of London's church wardens. Now, a lot of churches were destroyed in the Great Fire of London and destroyed during the Blitz. But every church that's ever existed in London still has a church warden, and they gather together every year and have this white tie dinner. So I was at this dinner, and the guy sitting next to me was very, very pompous. And he insisted that he could tell I had gone to Oxford or Cambridge by the way that I had tied my bow tie, which is totally ridiculous. So I took great delight in telling him that I actually went to Froome College in Somerset. So I hate pomposity. Anyway, yeah. Next question.
Oh, so is it true I heard that you'd worked at Longleat House with the Lions?
Absolutely true. So I'd applied for the police. In 1986, they'd had a big national campaign to recruit lots of officers, and competition was really fierce. So the statistic that they gave at that time is that for every one person who got a job as a policeman, there were 1,500 applicants. So it took me many, many months to actually be called up for training in 1987. So I worked for the summer at the Lions of Longleat. I worked in the monkey and lion enclosures. I was mucking out rhino. I did boat tours. Learned quite a big lesson, really, about, again, the great British public and how awful they can be. I can remember working on the monkey enclosure one day, and a guy turned up in a Rolls Royce, and he pulled up outside the enclosure. And, of course, this particular Rolls Royce had a vinyl roof. And I said to him, look, I wouldn't drive your car through there. And he was very, very dismissive. So I watched him drive into the monkey enclosure, and he was literally, his car was covered in monkeys that then proceeded to rip the entire vinyl roof off of his car. And he complained, of course, but we had a little camera that recorded all the time when we gave a declaration of damage, and he fell foul of that. So they Longleat never paid for the damage. I thought of another story there. I used to do the tour boats on the lake, and they were large fiber. They had large fiberglass animals on the front. So there was a seahorse and a swan. You get the idea of the type of thing. And I used to drive the one which had the swan on the front, and I'd steer with my foot, and you'd be talking the whole time through a microphone. So you'd talk about the dimensions of the lake, the capability brown landscape, and talk about the animals in the lake. And people would feed the sea lions, and I'd drive it past Gorilla Island. And there were two female gorillas and a male gorilla. And the male gorilla was totally disinterested in the girls. And he'd occasionally hurl poo at the tour boats, which was hysterical. And then one day I was driving along, and I'm talking about the pygmy hippos. Yeah. And I sort of gestured to the bank of the lake and said, look, you can see the baby calf there. I wonder where the adult female is. And with that, the whole boat lurched as I drove over the back of the hippo. And it was just, a nightmare. But anyway, that was Longleat. And yes, I did work there.
Wonderful. And then, is it true that you then ran away to join the circus, Graham?
It's not quite as romantic as that. I had a really good upbringing, but I always felt very constrained at home. My mum and dad were great at taking us on trips, and my dad used to give me his National Geographic magazines to read. Yeah. And that really inspired me to sort of get out into the big wide world. So I wanted to escape and forge my own path. So having worked at Longleat during the summer, during the winter, I was given the opportunity to go to the Chipperfields farm at Middle Wallop. So the Lions of Longleat was set up by Lord Bath and Jimmy Chipperfield, the famous circus family. So I was given the opportunity to go to this farm. So I went to Middle Wallop, pulled into the car park, and it was like Daktari. I went through a big metal gate, pulled into the car park, and the first thing I saw was a wallaby go by. It just bounced by. And then I was aware of something pressing its nose against the window, and it was an adult zebra just pressing its nose against my window. It was incredible. So I trained a couple of black stallions, Planet and Apollo, a guanaco, which is a small llama called Pepe, and a yak called Roly. And I got to work with Suzanne Chipperfield and a very old Jimmy Chipperfield, who were lovely. Suzanne was lovely and Jimmy was lovely, and that was fantastic. And then one day they said, would you take the yak and the llama to Spain to Mary Chipperfield, who was working in a circus? And that was just unbelievable, because in those days, Mary Chipperfield was a very big name.
Yeah.
You know, I'd grown up seeing her on Blue Peter and Jim Will Fix It and all that sort of thing. So I went out to Spain, and I've got to say, I've put here in my notes, she was formidable, but I'm going to be really honest. She was absolutely horrendous, horrible woman. But I was befriended by a stuntman called Cal Collini and his wife, Jane, and they sort of became my friends. Cal had been a stunt double for John Wayne in Hollywood. And one day he invited me into his caravan, and he had a big python that he used in his act. And he moved the python tank out and took out from underneath it a big leather belt. And the leather belt was all embossed by hand. And John Wayne had actually made that for him. And I was sworn to secrecy. So there you are. Yes, I worked in the circus.
Brilliant. Okay.
Next.
Can you tell us a bit more about your police career?
Joined in 1987, and I did 14 years. Served in Biddeford and then Exeter, uniform work, incident car. I was a community policeman. For those from Exeter, St. Thomas in Exeter, that was my patch. I then specialised in drug squad work, became an expert witness for the police around narcotics. That sounds very American. We didn't call them narcotics. They were just illicit drugs, but narcotics. I became a detective, did my CID course, specialising in major crime investigation, and then I joined the Force Crime Squad in the late 90s, where I worked on lots of murder inquiries, including Kate Bushell, which is a very famous murder inquiry of a schoolgirl down here in Exeter.
Yes.
I did lots of surveillance and stuff I can't talk about, all very hush-hush.
Yes.
But, you know, it all sounds very exciting, but surveillance largely meant sitting in a loft space or a room for several days or weeks.
Yeah.
And then finally you'd have 5 minutes of excitement at the end.
Yeah.
And the surveillance in vehicles was far more exciting. You know, we used to have sort of five cars and two motorcycles, and then we'd jump out the cars and follow people on foot and all that sort of thing. Actually, there was one occasion where I drove the wrong way down a street in Torquay following a very prolific paedophile. And I was stopped by the local police, and he just would not believe that I was a police officer on surveillance until finally the radio burst into life and it was headquarters telling him to let me go. But there we are. Yes, so that was my police career.
Brilliant. And did you enjoy that time?
It was very dynamic. There were times I loved it and times I hated it. One of the good things about it was that you could shift between different roles. So you might be a uniform officer working on the beat, and then you might be a dog handler or specialise in drugs like I did.
Yeah.
But sadly, I spent 14 years dealing with some very nasty people, and your view of the great British public can become a little jaded.
But I
had some fantastic colleagues, but there was the odd cop I met who the brightest thing about them was their buttons. but I achieved what I wanted to do. I wanted to be a detective, but in 2000 I left.
Right. Okay. So you must have some strange or funny stories about your time in the police that you can share with us.
Well, there were lots of really peculiar, everything was extreme. I'll tell you one of the funny things that happened when I was an acting detective in 1990. And my mentor was a guy called Phil Diss, who was a bit of a legend in Devon and Cornwall Police, who's sadly no longer with us. And we got sent on this very secret mission to a country house just outside Exeter. And on arrival, there were lots of men dressed in black with flak jackets and holding rifles. And there were police dogs searching around the building and grounds. And this guy walked over to us, and we identified ourselves with our warrant cards. And he held out a small metal tin, and it contains those little blue notice board pins. You know the type I mean?
Yeah, I know.
Okay,
yeah.
And we were instructed to put the pin in our jacket lapels. And when I asked why, I was told that the Prime Minister at the time, John Major, was about to arrive for a secret meeting. And this was to do with the Gulf War, the first Gulf War. And we were told that if it developed into a terrorist incident, we needed to have our little blue pins clearly on display. And we said, well, why? And they said, so you don't get shot. And it turned out there were marksmen around, and if they didn't see a little blue pin in your lapel, then you'd get shot if everything kicked off. So we spent the whole day sort of walking around with our thumbs behind our lapels showing off the pins. So I still have that pin. In my downstairs loo, I've got a framed signed picture of John Major, and that little blue pin is stuck in the frame.
Oh my gosh, that's fascinating. Yeah, really good. And didn't you get an award when you were in the police, Graham?
I got a couple of big awards. One was I got sent to an incident, reported as a disturbance, and we turned up, two cars went to it. And when I pulled up, I saw that there was a door smashed in a house. And I saw a young man come out of that house and go into the house next door. So I followed him, and my colleagues went into the house with the smashed front door. I didn't know it, but they'd gone in and found that the owner of the house was lying on in a heap on the floor, bleeding profusely from several stab wounds. And they were stuffing tea towels into him to stop him bleeding. And I went into the other house to find this young guy, and he was sitting on the sofa, and I started talking to him. And then his father came out of the kitchen, big guy, covered in blood, holding a knife, and he told me he'd killed the guy next door, and now he was going to kill me. So, we had a scuffle, and I got the knife off him, and I ended up with a chief constable's commendation, which is, again, in my loo.
That was one amazing thing. Well done, you.
The other incident was a bit stupid. You're told under no circumstances ever go into a house fire. And I went to a house fire in Whipton Village Road in Exeter, and it was one of those rare occasions where I arrived before the fire brigade. And all the neighbours were looking at me, and they said, there's an old lady in that house. So I went in to try and get her out, and she died, and I ended up in hospital. And that still lives with me today, had a very profound effect on me. I just need to smell a bonfire and I'm straight back in that house. But I'll tell you about how that links with my work at Devon and Sight a little bit later. Next question.
So you worked for Exeter City Council at the same time as you got your equity card, is that right?
Yeah, having left the police, I decided I needed to get a day job, so I worked in the mayor's office. And I prepared council papers, and I did the application for Exeter City to have a Lord Mayor as part of the Queen's Golden Jubilee. So that's why we've got a Lord Mayor. I did that application. But I've got to be honest, working at Exeter City Council was like working in a Charles Dickens novel, very old-fashioned, and there were some really nasty characters there, and I hated it. But it did give me, they let me work part-time so I could go off and do some acting in television and design stuff. So I had dual equity status. Well, I finally qualified for it. So as a designer and also as an actor. So I did lots of stage sets, big shows like Oklahoma, did that for Stage Electrics in Bristol. I produced the Bishopstock Blues Festivals with people like Jules Holland, Van Morrison, John Lee Hooker, for those who are into blues music. Did a big film at Dartmoor Prison called Lucky Break with Jimmy Nesbitt. They're all big famous names. Jimmy Nesbitt,
yeah,
Tim Spall,
absolutely.
Bill Nye, Christopher Plummer. I worked with Christopher Plummer. Wow, you know, he was in Sound of Music. That's pretty cool. So the other thing I did, I had to get a proper job eventually. But the other thing I did was I started working with a children's drama club in Exmouth called Centre Stage. And my partner at the time was musical director. And we both worked in professional theatre. So we got to design and produce shows for the kids like West Side Story, The Wizard of Oz, and my favourite, Phantom of the Opera. So that was really cool. And that group has had some great kids go through it. One of them, he's not a big name now, but Alistair Brahma was one of the kids that we gave a break to in West Side Story, and he played the lead in Cameron McIntosh's Miss Saigon. So, you know, that was a good old time.
Yeah, absolutely.
And one of the things about that time was what we tried to do with the kids was show them what would happen if you put professional values on an amateur show. So I designed all the programs and the posters, and I remember the kids getting very annoyed that the theatre was covered in all these posters for West Side Story, and they thought it was a professional tour that was going in, curiously the same time as they were doing West Side Story. And of course I just said, go and read the poster, and of course it was advertising Centre Stage. And it was great. It just took everything on to a new level, and we got sell-out sort of performances, which is really good.
Yeah.
Okay, next question.
So from there then, what motivated you to work in the charity sector?
I needed a full-time job. No, seriously. I've always done things for charity or the community. So yeah. When I was living in Topsham, I was a member of the Topsham Society, trying to preserve the architectural feel of Topsham. I was clerk to the River Commissioners. So I was particularly recruited just to do one particular job, which was to get boys, all the boys up the River X. I'm talking about river boys here, Louise. All the boys up the River X. It was me that got all the lights. They've all got lights on now, which they didn't. And they'd spent 13 years trying to get lights on the boys, but I did it in a year. So it's things like that. But eventually I joined an HIV and sexual health charity called Positive Action Southwest. Yeah. And I was there for 9 years. And it was a privilege, really, to give voice to such marginalized and stigmatized group of people. So I started in administration, but became the business manager for that. I negotiated all the contracts with the NHS and social services. A big social, European socially funded project about workplace, you know, HIV policies for the workplace and making employers to realize that it was very difficult to catch the virus. It's interesting, I'm talking about viruses then and viruses now. And that big piece of work won the Guardian Public Service Awards, which was pretty good. I went to Brussels and spoke about it there at a conference. And the big thing there was that one of our volunteers was a guy called Will Young. And Will, when he won Pop Idol, became a patron. So I did a big concert with him in Exeter Cathedral with all sorts of guest speakers and a choir of 250 kids. So that was a real highlight. But the downside of that particular piece of work and that time was that I ended up covering for a director who just kept on going sick and was having all sorts of mental health problems. So I never got the credit for the work that I did, but I was suddenly thrust into doing annual reports and funding bids. And in fact, it became a training ground for Devon Insight, really.
Yeah.
I helped merge that charity with a charity called the Edderstone Trust in Plymouth. And my reward for all of that work was to be offered voluntary redundancy at the end of it. Which was pretty horrendous.
Yeah.
But, you know, an old friend of mine always used to say, pick yourself up, dust yourself down, and start all over again. So that's what I did. So I set up a fine art company, and I had various licenses with the BBC, with Doctor Who, which, as you know, I'm quite passionate about. And I had the world rights for the last photographs taken of Titanic by Father Frank Brown for the centenary. I was negotiating with J.K. Rowling to do prints of the Harry Potter book covers, set designs for James Bond by Ken Adam and all that sort of stuff. But the recession hit and it just really wiped me out financially and sort of emotionally. And if I'm honest, I didn't like working from home and I missed having people around me. And I also didn't like the uncertainty of being self-employed.
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah.
I'm going to have a sip of my coffee now.
Okay, that's fine. So following on from what you just touched on, Doctor Who, so it's quite a random question. Is this true that you own a Dalek?
Doctor Who has been a passion of mine for 50 years, and I have a large collection of original props that includes a Dalek and a Cyberman. I've got the Doctor's robot dog. Do you remember K9? I own one of those.
Absolutely.
And I've got lots of original costumes worn by many of the Doctors. And what I do is I exhibit those every couple of years for charity. I worked at various BBC exhibitions, renovating props and costumes. I used to run big conventions. One of my best pals was a guy called John Nathan Turner. He was the producer of Doctor Who. He worked on Doctor Who from 1968 to 1989, and he was a great pal. And I met lots of actors and childhood heroes like John Pertwee, Tom Baker, and they've all become mates, which is really nice.
Yeah, that's lovely.
Yeah, so the highlight for me there really was I was asked to give a lecture at the British Film Institute in London for the 50th anniversary of the series, and I also worked on a big coffee table book about the series as well. So there you are, next question.
Amazing. So from there, how did you end up at Devon Insight?
You make it sound like a prison sentence.
Well, in the nicest possible way.
Yeah.
How did you become so fortunate?
There you go. I was living in Topsham, and yep. I was yep. a member of Topsham Sailing Club, and I crewed for a lovely man who was a university professor called Herbert McGregor, and we became great, great friends. You know, his field was zoology and genetics, and I always wanted to work in that field, I think. I wish I'd been a vet or something, I suppose. Anyway, I didn't like the sailing much, but I loved our conversations. And his wife, Alma, was a trustee at Devon Insight. And I helped, she came to me with a problem they were experiencing, an HR issue. And I helped her and the board with that. And many months later, Alma gave me a call and said that the charity was looking for a new leader. And I got the advert and I read it and I thought, you know what, this sounds really interesting. And there were 30 applicants for the post and I got down to the last two. And because the charity had been through a rough patch, I ended up having to go through psychometric training or testing before they made a decision. So it was a toss-up between you guys having an older guy and a safe pair of hands or me.
Yeah.
So you ended up with me. So I joined Devon Insight on April Fool's Day, 2013. Although my contract is actually dated the 2nd, but the first day I went in was April Fool's Day.
April Fool's Day. Say no more. So what experience of sight loss did you have when you joined the charity?
Well, it's really weird. At the time, I had that question on my interview panel, and I said not a lot. But, you know, I've been thinking about this quite a bit recently. My first experience of sight loss was my grandfather. My grandfather was blinded in World War II, and he was what was called a St. Dunstaner. You don't hear that expression anymore, but it's now Blind Veterans UK. So as a little boy, I remember him sitting in the corner. They lived near London Airport. And I remember him sitting in the corner and staring across the room, and I found him really scary as a child. But what I didn't know was that he had tunnel vision, and my dad used to describe it that when he looked at us, it was like the lead had been taken out of a pencil, and that was his vision of the world, was this tunnel vision.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until, I mean, he died in the 70s, but it's only in recent years that I've learned what a tough life he had. You know, he was one of 10 kids. He ended up fending for himself. He signed up for World War II when he was 15. So he did 100 days service before he was kicked out. And then he rejoined and ended up going out to Burma, I think, where he was blinded in action. You know, and now doing what I do here and now, I would just love to be able to turn the clock back and speak to him now as an adult, you know?
Yeah.
Anyway, back to sight loss. So in the early 80s, as I said, I volunteered reading the talking newspaper in Froome.
Yeah.
And in those days, everything was done on what was called a Revox reel-to-reel tape recorder, and we used to have to cut the old tape and glue it together. Glaucoma runs through my family and cataracts. My uncle, who died recently, was severely visually impaired. My aunt, who's 92, I spoke to her on the phone last night, and she said to me that for 18 years she used to read the Sutton Talking newspaper, and I had no idea about that until last night. And if I bring it bang up to date, and between you, me, and the callers, sadly, after years of alcohol abuse, my little brother has optic neuropathy, which has had a dramatic effect on his life. And let's just say I have an acute understanding of the effect that alcohol and sight loss can have on a person, but also on the extended family. And then in my notes here, I just put, I think it's important to say that I was recruited to manage a charity and develop its services. So I've sort of developed an understanding of sight loss, but that's not core to my role as the chief exec. Okay.
Yeah. So what did you do to change things when you came on board at Devon Insight?
I didn't. The first thing I did was observe, and I don't believe in changing things for the sake of it, but I quickly realized that we could make the customer experience better.
Yeah.
For people visiting the Old Resource Centre, and professionalise our back office work. Before my interview, I arranged to have a private 5-minute conversation with all of the staff on an individual basis. And this was very useful, as I was able to talk to them about the barriers to them achieving their roles. And, you know, that's where I started to bring in some changes. I know Jenny's listening, but I've put in my notes here, one of the best decisions was to appoint Jenny as our office manager, who also acts as my sort of PA. And Jenny has been my rock, really, throughout the whole time that I've been at Devon Insight. She knows when I'm flat. And, yeah. You know, we all have sort of times of euphoria and things are going well. But Jenny will, you know, just know when I'm a little bit flat and pick me up, which is great. If we look at the Resource Centre was largely transaction-based. So our relationship was, it was a bit like we were shopkeepers and it was a shop. There was nowhere to sit down and talk. There was no conversation, no fact-find. Why had that person really come to the Resource Centre? It wasn't just to buy a calendar. It was to talk about other things and problems. And we didn't have a confidential sort of space. And I was really keen that we would start to explore what was going on in people's eye health, other services that are available, training and entitlements. And I suppose what the big revelation for me was to realize that Devon Insight isn't the only sight loss association in the country. There are lots and lots of them, and we were working in a silo. And that's not healthy. Working in a silo isn't healthy. We didn't have anything to do with our partners in Cornwall or Somerset, and we sort of didn't fit into a national strategy. So I went to London for a national conference and realized that there were hundreds of organizations out there supporting blind and visually impaired people. And there were national strategies about trying to get all of the organizations from health, social care, and the sight loss sector to work more closely. So that sort of underpinned what we were doing. One of the first things we did was we already had low vision assessments taking place at the station house. And we got the sensory team to sit in on those. So for one consultation, you got two organizations working together. What else did we do? The big change was when we decided to look at national lottery type funding, big dollops of funding. So we spent about a year doing all the back office policies and procedures and eventually got the money and shifted the charity from being home office based to a community focus. And that's how we've ended up with the 13 talk and support groups, which were suspended obviously in March. The other big change was the development of our needs assessment, which people will have heard of, the sight loss MOT. That was the big thing that we had to do. I hope that answers that question.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so this is something we're all desperate to know the answer to. Can you confirm, is it true that you once had a leather whip delivered to the Devon Insight office.
Okay, thanks for this. This will be Jenny.
You're welcome.
Okay, right. I collect film props and costumes as well as Doctor Who.
Yeah.
So many of you will know the Indiana Jones films with Harrison Ford. So
yeah.
I own an original Indiana Jones hat, and the man who made Harrison Ford's jackets made me one to his original pattern. And I, as I say, I display stuff for charity. So there you are. So I thought, well, the costume obviously needs a whip because Harrison Ford had a whip as well as his gun. So I bought the whip very innocently, had it sent to the office. Now, Jenny opened my mail that morning and discovered that it had a whip in it. So she told me yesterday that she spent ages trying to wrap it up with tape and then just gave up. So I was chairing a meeting and she came in, she slipped in beside me and said, "Excuse me, Graham, your whip has arrived." And I think we just use it as an icebreaker with new staff just to, you know, make people laugh. But Jenny, like me, gets excited when I get a box from an online auction. I always get them sent to work because I'm never at home.
Yes.
So there you go. Thanks for that one.
Cleared that up. You're welcome.
Sure.
Right. So does Devon Insight have a USP?
Oh, what does USP stand for?
Unique selling point.
Well done. Just telling people who don't know. Okay. The human answer is quite simply that we take time to listen.
Yes.
It's a small word, but means so much to our clients. So many people comment that it's the first time that they've really felt that they've been heard. And there are things that our clients share with us that they would never share with their family or friends. So that very process can be very, very, very therapeutic. So that's the human answer. Of course, for funders, there's a slightly different answer, and it's that we take a holistic approach to our work. We put our clients at the heart of what we do. We look at the whole person and their own unique experiences and support them to access information, advice, and equipment and training from providers across health and social care and the voluntary sector. But again, our USP then, basically out of that sort of statement, is the MOT, that fact find.
Yes.
So our USP, I've been thinking about this, I see us very much as navigators. We help navigate people through that whole sight loss experience and the wealth of support services that are available. Go on. Next question.
Okay. So what would you say are your greatest achievements at Devon Insight?
Oh, I don't like that question.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Look, Devon Insight isn't about me, but I've been thinking about this. So what am I proud of? I'm proud of the team of trustees, volunteers and staff that I've recruited.
Yeah.
We couldn't achieve our strategic stuff if we didn't have people.
Yeah.
I was talking to Jill Brooks the other day, and Jill is she's our most recent trustee. And she first found Devon Insight when she was looking for information regarding her own sight loss condition.
Yeah.
And she said it wasn't until she came to the head office that she realized what a small team we were. She thought we were this enormous organization, but we're not. But I hope that we present ourselves in a very sort of professional way. Again, I've been rattling my brains, and I think there are a few things I just mentioned. Firstly is fire. Remember the house fire where the old lady died?
Yeah.
I was really pleased that I went to the Devon and Somerset Fire and Rescue Service, and many years ago, they used to do home safety checks, and that stopped. And I went to them, and I spoke about our clients, and it was exactly the same time that they had a fatal fire in Exeter. And they were having the same conversations, and we got together, and we devised something, and we spoke. And it's now something that not only Devon Insight, but practically every charity in the county offers people to be referred to the fire service. And it's Jenny. This is the wonderful thing about Jenny. You know, lots of people, we've met other charities and we say we do the fire checks. And people say, oh, yeah, we do this too. But Jenny reminded me the other day that actually we were the first and we set that up. So that's something I'm very proud about. getting rid of Station House. Station House was our head office. 1860s it was built, 1860, grade 2 listed. It was a nightmare. And we sold it, we got out of it. It was always difficult to park in Top Sherm. Nightmare, nightmare. And I walked past it last week, and it's covered in scaffolding at the moment. It's had all of the external render removed, and they're discovering problems. Yeah, we already knew it had dry rot and wet rot, but it's got loads and loads of stuff wrong with it. So I think getting, not that I had to force the board, but getting people behind me that we needed to get out of that building was really good.
Yes.
What else am I proud of? The community support service, you guys?
Absolutely.
I put here, I'm really pleased to have recruited such talented people.
Yes, yes.
I'm going to share something that happened last week, just so that people know what a lovely environment it is here. I asked Louise last week if she had a question that she wanted to ask me, and she paused for a second, and then Louise said, who is your favourite member of staff? So just for today, Louise, you are my favourite member of
staff.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you.
Okay, so again, people are at the heart of things. I'm really pleased what we've done with the newsletter. Do you remember I talked about making better production values when I was working with the kids' theatre? I've tried to replicate that at work. We've gone for a nice glossy newsletter when we're working normally. But since lockdown, we've been producing an in-house. We print it in-house. I record it at home. You know, we've been doing that, so people are getting a more regular thing. Two final things, our national standing. You know, we are part of that larger sight loss community nationally, and some people may have heard about Visionary, which is the umbrella organisation for all sight loss associations nationally. And I'm really pleased that we've now spoken at conferences. We've got nearly 20 charities now nationally that have adopted our sight loss MOT, which is testament not only to the team, but obviously the huge amount of work that Julian does for us. So Julian's one of those people who's quietly in the background at work, and Julian's been helping me innovate, and we designed the sight loss MOT together. So that's a great thing. And that sort of led to us winning the Visionary Award for Inspirational Service Delivery in 2017. So that was great. It was lovely to be awarded that by our peers. But we did it as a team, and that's really cool. And then one final thing I've got here was producing that promotional film. We did a promotional film last year that's available on the website. And I got to work with Alex Legere. Now, Alex lives in Topsham. He's a legend in BBC TV. He was a producer of Blue Peter for 35 years. And we approached him for help, and he helped me do this movie, and I'm very proud of that. And what's lovely is I bumped into him. I haven't seen him for a few months, and I bumped into him in Topsham but when I was walking past Station House. And he just said to me, I'd really like to work with you again. So that sort of thing, really important to me. So there we are. That's a few things that I really like.
Okay, we are running out of time slightly, Graham, so I think
I'm just going
to cherry pick
Go on.
A couple of other questions that we've got here, so we are going to leave some out, all right?
Okay, just tell me what number they are.
Number 24.
Okay.
Touch on that, because that's from a client. So what impact has it had on services now that Richard has left, and how has the gap been filled?
You know, it was really sad that we lost Richard. His post here wasn't specifically funded, and he had a really good knowledge of assistive technology, and that was combined with his lived experience of sight loss. He was able to go to talk and support groups to meet people and share this, but ultimately he took the decision to move on. We still send out catalogues and recommend equipment. So we've got tried and tested bits of equipment, and we can send out catalogues to people. So if people want to know about stuff, we can still do a bit of recommendation. But sadly, because of COVID, we cannot demonstrate equipment at the moment. But we know people that we can refer people into.
Yeah.
As you know, we've got these new speaker events in the coming weeks, and we've got some of the suppliers joining us for for these events. At the moment, behind the scenes, I can't say too much, but I'm working on a new assistive technology service offer at the moment, and I'm in the middle of contract negotiations with basically the country's largest supplier of assistive technology. This will be quite an innovative partnership, and we're sort of working on contracts and stuff. Now, we're hoping to launch that very shortly. I'm taking that proposal to the board next Friday. But that will hopefully see a bigger and better service offer, and that might even include home visits that the people that we're working with are actually able to do home visits at the moment with PPE. I hope that answers your question.
Yes, yeah, it does, very much so.
Go on.
Okay, so I will just start with that one. If we had unlimited funding, what would you like the charity to look like, Graham?
Oh, my God. I would love to have a client worker for every area of the county. Yes. So Torridge, North Devon, Southam, look at each of those sort of ward areas. I'd love to have somebody for each area.
Yeah.
I would like a dedicated community fundraising team.
Yes.
That's not just staff, but volunteers as well.
Yeah.
I would like a marketing and communications team. I'd like someone to liaise with the VI clubs and talk in newspapers on a regular basis. What else would I like? I'd like a cleaner for the office so I don't have to do it.
You're very good.
I'd like a personal butler who could bring me endless cups of coffee and a glass of something nice for lunch.
Yeah.
How about champagne for board meetings?
I think so.
Aston Martin. I tell you what, an Aston Martin DB8 as a company car. That'd be cool.
Seriously,
I actually think that too much money can make charities complacent. Mm-hmm. Lean and mean and being slightly fearful about the future, I think that stimulates creativity and innovation.
Yeah.
But that said, I would just love to have a slightly bigger team. You know, people are our greatest asset.
Yeah. No, absolutely.
Go on.
Very true. Okay, so we're just going to look at the last two questions very quickly. What are your plans for the future?
What, me personally?
Well, I don't know. You know, it could be.
Yeah.
For the charity, you?
Okay. Well, firstly, Devon Insight isn't the Graham Flynn Show. The senior management team work with the board to come up with our strategic plans.
Yeah.
So I might be a catalyst, but we are very much a team that take things forward. So, of course, the big thing that came along that's really, I was trying to get a polite word out then, really scuppered things is COVID-19.
Yeah.
But I think it's very important. One of the things I've tried to do throughout all of this pandemic and sort of looking at stuff is that you're always looking to the future. There will come a time when we're no longer talking about COVID. It's a crisis, but you know what, COVID's going to be with us for a while, and I think people need to be realistic here. It's not going to disappear. It's going to mean we hear all these expressions about herd immunity. Even when they've got vaccinations, it's going to take a long time for the population of Earth basically to be vaccinated and to eradicate it. And there are variations of the virus and all that sort of stuff. So we've got the COVID thing, which is a sort of biological hazard, I suppose. We've then got, dare I mention it, the other big word, Brexit. Brexit still hasn't happened. You know, that doesn't really come into full force until the 31st of December, and that's going to impact on all sorts of things. Yeah. So here we are. My immediate priorities are income generation.
Yeah.
This year, can I remind everybody, this year was or is our 95th anniversary, and all of our community fundraising events have been cancelled. The big lottery, that funding came to an end at the end of October. So we'd prepared an application to go in March, April, but there's an embargo on the national lottery or the big lottery. So we've got to get a new bid ready for when that embargo disappears, and we're hoping that will be in the autumn. Well, we're in the autumn now, let's say before Christmas. So the other big priority is keeping people connected. So that's why we've designed these sight loss speaker events. I'm negotiating that new assistive technology service. I'm going to bring in, I tell you what would be lovely is just to get Tracy in, if you can unmute her. Because we put it in the newsletter. I just want to make people aware of our long-term aspiration to help people a little bit more with well-being. So that's our Feeling Well, Keeping Well service. Tracy, are you there?
I am, Graham. I am.
Hooray.
You're a bit of a hard act to follow, actually. just very briefly, what with COVID and what have you, and Graham was talking about listening, how important it is to listen to the people that we work with. During COVID, my colleagues and I were making lots of telephone calls to our clients, and a lot of people were telling us how important those calls were. So what we've been working on behind the scenes, and what we're actually happy to actually talk about now, is our Feeling Well, Keeping Well service. So really, really excited about this, and it comes in two parts. The first part is an informal chat if anybody is having any issues or they need some kind of emotional support that they can't get from family or friends. We're offering a chat actually with me. So during that chat, we'd actually be able to discuss options for any kind of additional support if needed. And here's the biggie as far as I'm concerned. We're now actually working with the RNIB and Living Options, and we will be able to offer free counselling sessions to people with sight loss in Devon and Torbay. So this is really big for us. So, but that was it in a nutshell.
That's absolutely fantastic. You know, we talked about having a strategic direction. If you don't have a plan for the next 3 to 5 years, you don't aspire to make change. So we've talked about counselling. It always comes up every time we talk, and it's a very expensive thing to do, but it's the right thing to do. So we've added that to our sort of strategic work at the moment. The other big thing that I think we're doing at the moment, and it's work I'm doing with you, Louise, is to try and help integrate our services into what the hospital are doing, and social services and the voluntary sector as a whole. And that's called, in our sight loss world, that's called the Adult Eye Health and Sight Loss Pathway. And we're trying to work more closely with the hospital. So that's a thing that I really want to do at the moment. And the other thing is one of those, it sounds boring, but it's really, really important to my role as chief exec. And that's the awful word, sort of compliance. So I'm working with Kathy at the moment on reviewing all of our safeguarding. So that's how we keep clients safe and our volunteers. And that's a big piece of work that we're doing at the moment. There you go. Next question.
All exciting things. We've actually run out of time, Graham.
Okay.
We've got to keep the calls to under an hour for people's inclusive phone packages.
Okay.
So I'm ever so sorry, but I'm going to have to thank you so, so much for the fascinating answers to these questions. And apologies to everybody on the line that we have run out of time and can't open it up. But if there are any burning questions you want put to Graham, you can either let your community support worker know, or you can contact our head office. Okay, and I will give you the number for that one. So our head office is 01392 876666. Okay. Remember, we're going to be hosting these calls every Tuesday at 10:30, and next week is the 24th of November. We're thrilled to welcome Louise Isaacs, who will be speaking about the NHS Low Vision Clinic. So really looking forward to that. So if you've got any questions for Louise, hopefully she won't talk as much as Graham, so we can... questions to her next week. So again, you can phone our helpline number on 01392 876666. All right, so thank you all so much for joining us this morning, and I hope you found it interesting. I know I certainly have. And thanks again to Graham, very much appreciated.
Thank you.